Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. We got something really interesting for you today. We are going to mash together World War One with the ancient world. Lockie, tell people how, why, and who.
I'm excited about this. I think it's going to be good. I've got my notes here ready to go because I'm going to be swatting on this for my battlefield touring when we can go again. We've got Owen Rees and Giles Penman here. Owen's a historian of warfare. And the pre-modern world, so more generally. His specific research interest lies in the transition of soldiers from civilian life to the battlefield and back again, including all the kind of psychological and sociological problems that arise from this. His books include Great Battles of the Classical Greek World and Great Naval Battles of the Ancient Greek World, so boaty stuff too. Giles is a PhD student at Warwick University. He looks at ancient history and material culture. In particular, the deployment of Greco-Roman imagery on the civil cultural artifacts of the Great War and its post-war commemoration, which is pretty dapper. So essentially what we're going to be looking at today is shades of the ancient world in commemoration of the Great War, which is something that, well, until Owen wrote this article that I've been reading for the Great War group last year, I hadn't noticed, to be honest.
As well, absolutely 100% guilty. Do you know who else is guilty? Alina, because Owen's been on before talking about sociological impact of war in the ancient world, and she neglected to mention that you were an expert on boaty battles in the ancient world. You should have had a podcast on that by now, the sly cow. I'm going to have her up on that one. She's evading the boatiness.
Well, everyone ignores ancient boats anyway. There's no cannons, there's no Trafalgar. So it barely exists to everyone else. Let her off.
Well, they do smash into each other, though, which is a rugby player kind of appeals to me.
Yeah. We're going to do one. We're going to do boaty battles of the ancient world, and she's going to sit through it, and she's going to like it. That's going to be our punishment. Giles, hello. This is your first time on History Hack. Welcome.
Yes, sir. Thank you for inviting me to speak. Now, it's to... having a classical background as well means that I have a great appreciation for Owen's work. Having studied classics at university at undergraduate level, and then sort of moving on to more material and culture thereafter, has given me a great appreciation for how very much the ancient world has influenced subsequent centuries, including the Great War and its commemoration. So it's something that I really do enjoy researching, and something that I look forward to telling you more about.
Awesome. I mean, I think we jump straight into it then. I mean, Owen, one of the first things that we think about in terms of commemoration of the Great War is the cemeteries. And anyone who's been out there and seen the kind of rows of white headstones, those images do stay with you. Do we want to say the ancient Greeks were among the first to move away from the concept of just leaving the dead on the battlefield?
Yeah, so the ancient world is always, it's a problem in all military action, isn't it? Which is, we all focus on the hows, the whos, the wheres, the whys. And afterwards, the aftermath of battle is always political aftermath, it's personal aftermath, it's psychological aftermath, some of my own work. Or, you know, wider military campaigns. No one ever thinks of the physical aftermath, which is, what do you do with the dead? And there's always quite a lot of them. Mm. It's not just the ancient world. Of course, this is any issue in any military activity. You know, think of Waterloo and the bodies left on the battlefield there. You know, think of the Somme, which is obviously an obvious one. It's a common problem. And for the Greeks, there was a real fear that your body would be left on the battlefield. If you were killed in battle, it would be left, and it would be left to the birds and the scavengers. This was a real insult and a threat projected onto you. I mean, Homer's Iliad, this epic poem, possibly one of the first epic military engagements that we see, the opening line that people may have heard of about the anger and the rage of Achilles, which is the famous bit of the opening line. The actual end of that first sentence talks about bodies on the battlefield, and it talked about the threat of the dogs and the carrion birds eating your body, because no one cared. No one buried you. No one looked after you. This was a real fear in the psyche of the Greeks. Not unique to the Greeks, to be fair. You know, we hear Sumerian monuments talk about burying the dead in some way. So whilst we're talking about leaving bodies on the battlefield, there's often been a social drive to at least offer a burial of some sort, usually to your own, not necessarily to the enemy. So in Greek warfare, this is where we are. The concerns for the dead on the battlefield are a serious one. They are so serious in Greek warfare that victory in battle was not determined by who had more men die. It was not determined by who actually held the battlefield necessarily, who retreated necessarily. It was determined by who controlled the bodies of the dead. A battle in ancient Greece was kind of officially ended when a truce was called and the bodies were exchanged, so you would give back the dead of the enemy, showing once again the kind of the prestige and also the care and the due diligence that was offered to even your enemy. Okay, we can kill you, we can strip your body of armor, we'll strip you of all your valuables, but we're not monsters. We'll give you back to be buried. So this is where we are. So most Greek city-states in the classical period, 5th, 4th century BC, they bury their dead on the battlefield. If they're in enemy territory and they've lost, they may take it to a nearby allied territory to bury them, but it's always near to where they are. Okay. There is kind of a logistical reason for this also, which is that it's very hard to move a lot of bodies. It's not the easiest thing to achieve. The human body is quite heavy. Moving one is not easy. Moving 10 is particularly hard. If you're talking about 500, how on earth do you do it in a pre-mechanized society? So they come up with this idea, bury on the battlefield. The Spartans, with this great military reputation they hold, they bury them on the battlefield. The Argives, the Corinthians, the Thebans, all these people bury them on the battlefield. One city-state that is missing from that normality is Athens. The sort of the radical democratic state Athens are the first city-state, they're the first state of any description in Europe at least, who make a very different decision. They decide that they are not going to continue burying the dead on the battlefield. They're going to bring them home in what we refer to as a repatriation of the dead. Now, this repatriation of the dead was not only a huge logistical undertaking, they burnt the bodies on the battlefield. Think about the amount of wood that would take. Think about the amount of time that would take. The human body does not burn very easily. You know, go talk to anyone who studies Nazi Germany and dealing with the horrors there. Burning bodies is not easy to achieve. So Athens does this and they repatriate the bodies. They go further than that. They offer them a public spectacle, a public funeral for the war dead. In it, the remains are put into coffins, 10 specific coffins, which are paraded through the streets and buried. It usually happens once a year, especially during the Peloponnesian War towards the end of the 5th century, where we have like over 20 odd years of continuous military engagement. So this is a lot of investment by the state to repatriate and to honour the war dead in a way that actually feels very modern and very relatable. You know, the state takes control of the dead. It offers them this this prestigious funeral, a funeral that often it was only really available to the rich and people who were rich enough to bring back the bodies, people who were rich enough to erect their own statues, their own monuments. Athens was offering this in almost a democratic way. We're going to give this to you, the everyman. We're going to give you this honour. So in that way, yes, this is Greece, ancient Greece, or specifically ancient Athens, is where we see a very distinctive in this relationship between the state and the war dead and what to do with the dead on the battlefield.
So after we've dealt with the dead, we get to the idea of war monuments. And this is something that wholly epitomises our work as battlefield guides, Lockie. Monuments cenotaphs and the cenotaph in particular. Tell us, Owen, where do these ideas come from? Where does this idea come from of putting up a stone monument to your war dead and inscribing names on it? It comes from the ancient world, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. The monuments that are erected in Athens for the war dead are what are referred to as pasargadae. So these are large stelae, so stone erected monuments, often with a beautiful sculpted image on top. So heavy investment goes into it, and you list the war dead on a particular campaign or a particular year. So this is where that kind of monumentalism comes in to the relationship with the war dead and the state. Cenotaphs. Now, cenotaphs are ever so slightly different. Mm-hmm. So a cenotaph in the ancient Greek world comes from the word cenotaphion, which literally translates as empty tomb. So a cenotaph is an empty tomb, is what it is. It is outside of Whitehall. That's what that represents. The one in Manchester, that's what this represents. It's exactly the same. An empty tomb is something in ancient Athens that wasn't a monument erected by the state. It was usually erected by your family. And they would erect it because they do not have your body. Hence, the tomb is empty. So we actually see this used in Athens for non-military death as well. The most famous example, or the most famous person that we know had a cenotaph, was the tragedian Euripides. So Euripides died in Macedon, allegedly, and we have the surviving inscription recorded at a much later date, the inscription that was on his cenotaph, because the family didn't have the body. So they erect the cenotaph so they have a place to go, have a ritual site where they can go and remember their family member. And this is the tradition that picked up at the end of the First World War, at a point where the British state in particular, looking for guidance on how to commemorate, how to offer something to all these men who have died in a completely unprecedented period of warfare. And they looked to the ancient past and they found in the original democracy, imperial democracy boot, they found the perfect model. And the cenotaph was imitated on this, the joining of these two ideas. So the public funeral, the honor of the dead that Athens gave, and this Greek concept of the cenotaph. And if you actually go and look at the cenotaph in Whitehall, for instance, you will see it covered in classical imagery and classical iconography. Think of it. The classic would be the wreath, the circular wreath, which is common in Athenian and, dare I say, Roman iconography, because it's one of victory. Yeah. We also see, Roman numerals and things like that, you know, all harking back to a classical precedent. On the cenotaph in Manchester, this goes a step further. They have a wreath as well, but they also have two obelisks either side of the central plinth as it is. And these two obelisks, again, evoking the ancient world, obelisks associated with Egypt and in many ways Rome as well. They are decorated with carved ribbons, a drape along the side of it. And this is straight out of classical Athenian pottery, art. This is how Athenian people, Athenian families in particular, would decorate the graves of their dead. This is the imagery that the British state, the political elite of Britain, are calling upon when they're trying to find a way of showing as much respect they can to their dead. They call upon a language, an iconographic language. It goes back 2,500 years.
Do you think they do this because of the public school by education that a lot of them have gone through? Giles is like, is this part, are they subconsciously doing it or is it intentional, Giles?
I would say that this is intentional, but the work of Elizabeth Van Diver and also Edith Hall and Henry Stead have suggested that actually classical knowledge was not just the preserve of the elite. Whilst the elite learned it in private schools and grammar schools, working class people were also imbued with a great deal of classical knowledge through English translations and compendia and condensations of classical texts and classical histories, but also through the use of neoclassical sculpture as part of architecture in public buildings. And so whilst the elites may have whether they be the artists or politicians with classical educations may have made these decisions, they were still making those decisions in the full knowledge that all sections of society would understand the messages they were trying to promote about the war dead.
Absolutely. And I think that's an important point. So whilst we focus on the elite and whilst we focus on decision making going on, they are also, I completely agree with Giles, they're reflecting an idea that the public buy into. Don't forget that the Cenotaph of Whitehall was originally made temporary, and the massive queues that formed when it was unveiled pretty much forced the hand of the decision makers. They pretty much forced the hand, we have to make this permanent, because the people have spoken with their feet. It really did tap into something that they believed. And I half wonder if this is also very similar to the Athenian idea. So the Athenian idea, as I said, I'm going to give you a burial that is only usually given to the rich. I'm going to give you something that your normal standing in society does not afford you. Mm. Whereas something like the cenotaph, something like what was given to the soldiers in the First World War, it was not normal. This is seriously an honourable thing to be given. This is an amazing thing to be given for working class people, to be offered such an amazing monument to themselves, to be buried, to be given headstones, even if it is at the Somme, even if it is at Ypres, wherever it is, to be given those kind of monuments is not normal.
No, it's a complete step up. You didn't see that at all with the Boer War, did you?
But I think part of the desire to create a schema of commemoration in this way is because of the public outcry at the way in which the gravestones and cemeteries of the Boer War dead were mistreated and abandoned after the conflict, and indeed influenced to some extent by the way in which after the American Civil War. The American public wished for their dead to be known and to be named, something that Thomas Lacker speaks about a lot in his work on the subject of naming the naming the dead, that actually there is this great drive to in the end of the 19th century towards the formalized commemoration of war dead.
Yeah, Lockie, it's got to be part of the uproar about not bringing people home from the Western Front because we couldn't afford to. And the Americans got the option. We didn't, did we? Because it cost so much money. It was decided to leave them where they'd fallen in France and Belgium. But in doing that, you've then got to put a significant amount of funding and respect behind it, haven't you?
Well, yeah, absolutely, and it goes beyond just the kind of physical remains of the soldiers as well. And it's fine where you do have those physical remains, and you can erect a headstone or something like that. But just the nature of the fighting in the Great War, you know, with artillery being such a powerful element on the battlefield, it's quite often that there's very little to find of a person, or it's very, very difficult to identify. And so we end up with these huge memorials like the one at Tietvel, like the Menin Gate, with literally, you know, tens of thousands of names on, many, many thousands missing on the battlefield. Now, in the same year that the cenotaph was unveiled on Whitehall in its kind of permanent form, we also had the Unknown Warrior brought and installed in Westminster Abbey. Is that a feature from the ancient world as well?
It actually is. Now, this is a feature that's kind of underappreciated. There is a lot of scholarship on the what we call reception. I mean, Giles and I are both talking about, we're talking about the reception of the ancient world in other time periods for this conversation, the First World War. By reception, we mean basically, how does another culture receive the ancient world themselves? How do they interpret it? What do they do with it? So, you know, I've talked about the Athenian funeral. I've talked about the kind of iconography on show. And Giles has talked more about that, no doubt. So this is a reception of the ancient world. So it's not an accurate portrayal of the ancient world. It is another culture using the ancient world as it wants. And there's loads of work on this to do with the casualty lists, to do with the monuments of the war dead. But there's nothing on the burial of the unknown warrior. This is particularly interesting because the supposed originator of the idea, Reverend David Railton, was himself trained in classics at Macclesfield Grammar School. And before he went into training to be a reverend, he has a good background in Greek and Latin. And anyone who's had to study Greek has had to suffer reading Thucydides, who is the man who gives us this funeral source.
I really enjoyed Thucydides when I studied at A-level, but I suppose suffering it is perhaps a bit harsh. But yeah, I do.
Giles, I am afraid that makes you deviant. You are a deviant person. Wow, I've met one. That's impressive. To be fair, I have to use Thucydides a lot. I like his work. God, his Greek is hard, and it's just dense. So David Railton will have read the funeral oration is most famous in Thucydides. This is the funeral oration, the speech that was given by the statesman Pericles over the war dead. It's the only speech given in Thucydides for this funeral. And it is so iconic. It is constantly reused by politicians into the modern day. Snippets of the speech appears at things like Gettysburg Address. It appears at numerous American presidents have used sentiments from this speech. It speaks to freedom, it speaks to democracy, and it speaks to civic duty. Okay. The one area that people don't really focus on is the small little logistical bit at the beginning where he talks, as I mentioned earlier, about the funeral itself. All right. So the war dead are cremated on the battlefield. Those cremains are put in coffins. 10 coffins. There are 10 tribes of Athens in your tribal. They are buried. What is also buried with those coffins is an empty bed, specifically an empty funeral bed. This is dressed for funeral rites. What this bed is emulating is what would happen in a house if you died at home. The family would create a funeral bed. They would dress you, they would wash you, they would prepare you for funeral. This is the funeral bed they are emulating. And the suggestion is, although Thucydides isn't completely clear, the suggestion is that that bed may well have been buried as well with the war dead. So you've got to ask the question, why on earth is an empty bed being buried along with the remains? And Thucydides tells us it's for those that can't be found or could not be identified. Now, you mentioned earlier about modern warfare and the issue of artillery and the issue of basically things like the RAF and the Second World War and, you know, the issues of collecting all the remains. The ancient world doesn't quite have that problem. They have another problem, which is that the majority of bodies that are lost in a naval battle are not easily retrieved. And then when you realize that Athens is predominantly a naval power and that they exert their force through their naval activity, a lot of their deaths are at sea. So it's intriguingly, this bed seems to predominantly be there for those bodies that could not be returned. And the obvious what there is, those lost at sea. These are the many men who would have died in the naval campaigns that allowed Athens to have the empire it had, the empire that it needed to afford this funeral, among other things. So they bury this now. What we have here is a symbolic burial for those that cannot be returned. This is the complete ideological underpinning to the burial of the unknown warrior and the cenotaph. So the cenotaph gives you a monument for those that cannot be returned, which in the First World War is everyone, predominantly. And then you have the burial of one person, a symbolic burial of one person, unknown, for all those who could not be buried at home, for all those who are missing, for all those who do not get the rights that the state believe they do deserve. And as you've already said, they can't afford to give. And for me, that is just such an obvious echo of the Athenian practice. There's just such an obvious emulation of the ideology of the burial of the dead at that public funeral. So whilst it is not categorically proven that David Railton was emulating, it is at least worth noting that the underpinnings to both those ceremonies are the same, and for the same reason.
All right. I mean, that's absolutely fascinating. I love these ties. And just pushing the conversation onto kind of maybe more personal tokens of, you know, remembrance or service. We quite often think of the medals, be they campaign medals, service medals, victory medals. And Giles, just turning on to you, because you're into this, aren't you, medals? Where do these fit in?
Yes, so whilst I began my PhD research by looking at military medals, I've more moved into the commemorative medals of the war, but those that commemorate Peace Day in 1919. But certainly military medals functioned for the men themselves and for the relatives of those that died as almost personal memorials to their service and to the memory of the life of the person who died. So they have that dual function, remembering both the military aspect of service, but also the person that they represent, person whose service they represent, and they can be quite important for the commemoration and remembrance of relatives who served in conflict for the family, because by being produced by the state, they form part of the official recognition of that service, so certainly that they are important for families and for family history going down the generations. It is one reason why they become heirlooms and why families today still have them in their possession. But for me, it's the Greco-Roman imagery on some of these smaller personal items of the First World War that are significant. But by not depicting the warfare, modern warfare as it took place during the conflict with the bombs and the bullets and the barbed wire, but instead replacing them with a classical aesthetic, it sanitizes the war of its horror and removes it by removing it from its immediate 20th century context and setting it into an ancient past. And so it makes it seem as though the conflict happened centuries ago, far out of reach of the emotions of the relatives who and servicemen who all went through the war in one way or another. whether that be losing a relative who served or losing friends to alongside whom they served. Classicism took on this cleaning aspect. It cleaned the war and made it easier to come to terms with those difficult emotions. But also because it creates this image of ancient legendary experience, through the use of Greco-Roman imagery, it presents the war dead as heroes almost. They are soldiers and sailors and airmen whose service was akin to that of Roman legionaries who processed in triumph after great military victories at the end of campaigns, or like Greek warriors who had gone through battle and then had been given great honor by the state or stelae or cenotaphs if they had died. In that way, they provide the classical imagery provides consolation for the bereaved and for fellow servicemen as well. And those are the two strands, of purpose that I study.
Is it winged victory, the actual imagery of the medals? Is that?
Yes, that is what appears on the victory medal, and again that provides a similar type of consolatory imagery to the servicemen themselves. That because victory appears to be awarding a laurel wreath, which is an ancient victory prize given to particularly ancient Roman legionaries after the battle, after long and hard campaigns. It's a symbol that the men during the First World War are worthy of similar plaudits, worthy of similar honors, and it's a way of consoling them that despite the hardships they suffered, they are indeed worthy of great praise.
So I'm now thinking about where else we might see ancient imagery in respect to First World War objects, and we've got memorials, we've got medals. Are there any others?
Yes, that there are. So that there is the on the printed media of the Great War, so posters and sketches discharge certificates, you'll find images of Britannia, who is the ancient personification of the British nation, originally created by the Romans in the first century AD after the Roman conquest of Britain, and this figure then became a prominent representation of the British nation from the Renaissance onwards. Through her depiction in architecture, but particularly on coinage, where even today Britannia appears on the 50 pence piece, but she appeared on the bronze coinage of every monarch since the late 17th century onwards, and so really became solidified as a symbol representing the nation. And during the Great War, on printed media, Britannia is heavily used by the government on government sponsored posters to mobilise the nation, whether that be mobilising them to join up in very traditionally gendered roles. So men were encouraged through the use of Britannia to join the fighting services, combatant services rather than non-combatant services, and women were encouraged to join uniformed services in which they engaged in traditionally female gendered activities, aiding fighting for the fighting men through supply and logistics and nursing. But also Britannia was used to encourage civilians on the home front to save bread and become teetotal, to not to abstain from alcohol, as part of the broader pledge by politicians and religious leaders at the time to reduce alcohol consumption within Britain to boost productivity, whether it be in the factories or elsewhere. I argue as part of my research that the use of Britannia's image was actually unsuccessful in achieving these aims because of the reality of the war. The reality is that working class people were able to earn enough money to earn more money, in fact, than they did before the war through war work, and thus were able to afford more food, and so they didn't need to save bread. And then government regulation meant that people couldn't really obtain high strength alcohol when the pubs were open. So Britannia's image didn't really have an effect on trying to patriotically encourage people to drink less, because government regulation meant they couldn't anyway.
Talking about people's reactions, then, are you saying that they're kind of ambivalent towards this ancient imagery that's being used in some cases?
I would say so. I would say that it may have encouraged people, some citizens, to act patriotically, but in a broad sense, yes, they did become ambivalent, because this image, the image of Britannia, had been so heavily used in British society that it kind of ceased to have a potency. It ceased to have a power. It was used on a lot of the bronze coinage at the time, and then in architecture as well. And if you're seeing it every day on the posters, it just ceases to have the same sort of meaning. But also that the harsh reality of the war meant that this image ceased to have a mobilizing force. So as stories came back from the Western Front about the death and destruction on the battlefield, the recruiting numbers fell dramatically, requiring conscription, and there was nothing that Britannia's image on posters could do to prevent that. However much the British government wished to present combatant warfare as a patriotic duty for every right-thinking British person, there was just no way that could trump the reality of the conflict. That it was just being presented. It was just a real slaughter. Although, of course, statistically that wasn't the case. Only about 1 in 6 frontline soldiers actually was killed. But the presentation of the reality, and indeed the harsh reality of living conditions as well on the front, meant that it just wasn't going to happen.
Just got me thinking there, Giles, about the changing relationship with the ancient world as the reality kind of hits. I mean, the obvious one for me is the one perception of the ancient world most people will know, even if they don't necessarily know it, which is the phrase dulce et decorum est pro facto mori, made famous by Wilfredo's poem. You're absolutely right. So from the Horace, the reason why I say that is that you say that to most people now, they'll immediately go to the war poetry, like Blackadder's endless poetry. They immediately go, that's the irony in that statement, the idea that there is nothing sweeter or more fitting than to die for one's country. Fatherland is, of course, steeped in irony, and the horrors of the war kind of show that. And yet, if you go and look at quite a few of the war memorials around the country, they have part of that phrase quoted. Mm. And you know, when they were first erected, this is the idea, they die for their fatherland. Let's go to the ancient world. The ancient world tells us this is a great thing. And yet when we start to get, the proper aftermath of the war, Wilfred Owen's poems published 1920, I think it is?
1920, yes. Yeah.
So you've got this evolving relationship with the ancient world, and actually now that phrase has lost the meaning that the war memorials wanted it to have, and in many ways has created a more poignant monument now because it has that sense of irony.
And indeed, this is something that the secret.
Go on, you.
Sorry, and they did, that's something that Siegfried Sassoon comments upon in his poem "Men and Gate." He's very clear that he disapproves of the classical aesthetic being used to represent the war, because it doesn't, to his mind, it doesn't represent anything that the war was about. It doesn't represent the fighting as it happened, or indeed any of the sentiments that the soldiers feel about it.
I'm so glad you two are up on your poetry, because Lockie and I are like, ooh, war poetry.
In classics, you've got to do a bit of poetry.
Well, I mean, a lot of the words to do with commemoration were, you know, had some of the great wordsmiths of the day involved in. I mean, Rudyard Kipling is famously involved in a lot of this. So, I mean, you go to a cemetery, you'll see with the Stone of Remembrance, you know, designed by, that's Blomfield who designed that, isn't it? And the words on there are, their name liveth forevermore. And you have on some of the headstones, which have been maybe hit by shell fire, and we're not sure where the grave is in the cemetery, their glory shall not be blotted out. And these kind of these expressions, which then, you know, you tie into the oration. If you go to the last post in Ypres, you'll hear, they shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. So this idea of the words follow the concept of the immortal dead, don't they? And so let's talk about that for a second, Owen, if you don't mind. Its connotations with the ancient world.
Yeah. So you've always got to ask the question when a society does something out of the ordinary, it's because it's worth doing. No other state in the ancient world in the ancient European world, at least, is doing anything like a repatriation process. Why are they doing it? What is going on? So it's often this repatriation is aligned with democratic ideology. It's often how it's explained. So you've got this new democracy. You're trying to convince people to go to war. Whenever you want to go to war, Athens is a radical democracy. It is a completely direct democracy. So the people who vote to go to war are the people who are going to do the killing and the dying. They are the same people. So you've got to, as a state, as a society, you've got to offer them something. And when you look into the wordsmithery, as you kind of point out, of the funeral orations, you notice that the one thing that keeps coming up is what the dead get offered. What they get offered are kind of manifold. One is they get to become heroes. Well, I mean that in a very colloquial sense, but I also mean that within a Greek religious sense. So a hero is actually more than just someone you look up to. A hero is, deserves a place next to other divine entities, such as, at the very top end, the gods, obviously. The heroes are like Hercules, Perseus, Theseus, all these great names we know from mythology. They had religious cults dedicated to them, had sacrifices given to them. They were called upon. They were prayed to. They are part of this kind of wider Greek religious sphere. And this is what's on offer to the war dead. So if you die in war, you have this funeral, and during this funeral, you are transformed as a group to become a heroic entity who can be called upon and who has honours and who have athletic games in your name, things like that. So there's a real sense of what's given to you. But because of that, something else that's on offer is immortality. Now, immortality to the Greeks is literally not dying. But of course you are dead. How are you going to not die if you're already dead? But what they offer is your immortality, which becomes this heroic entity, is your memory and the memory of your deeds. This is what we hear time and time again. You will be remembered. Your memory will be immortal. And our annual commemoration to the war dead will continue your immortal existence. Okay. So this is what the Athenians offer. And of course, this has obvious echoes in modern commemoration of the war dead. You mentioned a few there. You know, it is the undying memory. It's quite a common thing you read about. The ageless dead, but of course they will no longer grow any older. You know, they will never be forgotten. There is a sense of infinite commemoration being presented. And it was important to the Athenians that this was what was being offered to them, because otherwise, you've got to think of it in terms of motivation. How do you motivate these men to go to war? How do you motivate them to vote for the war if they know that if they die, that's it, gone, done, nothing else? So it's perhaps not a surprise that next to this ideological foundation of the war dead and this promise of immortality through memory, Athens also has a system of payment to war orphans. And there's a suggestion that they may well also have assisted widows in some way. So there is a very realistic or practical offer of, you know, we will look after your family, the society will look after your family, your children will grow up. And at 18, a war orphan is given a full set of military armor and weaponry by the Athenian state. Of course, the underlying idea being is you're now going to replace your dad. And that's exactly what the speech is saying. There's quite a horrific moment where Pericles calls upon the families at the funeral and basically says, women, shut up, stop crying, and go have more babies. If you're too old to have more babies, don't worry, you've done your job. Men, stop crying. You know, you now need to go and try and emulate your amazing ancestor or your amazing brother. And if you haven't, you haven't quite lived up to the masculine ideal, but it's okay. So, you know, this is all about motivating. This is all about the state motivating men, women, children to continue what they need them to do, which is to produce more warriors, basically. There's a really nasty imperial underpinning to this democratic ideology, which is easy to ignore.
I'd just like to say that it's that same idea of immortality that I think the memorial plaque, which is given to the families of those that died after the First World War, the plaque is trying to emulate that same idea of immortality, with Britannia giving a wreath out a wreath of laurel over the top of the name of the person who's commemorated. So it's almost as though Britannia, i.e. the British nation, is trying to confer that same sense of immortality and heroism onto the deceased in that very, very personal memorial, which was designed to be displayed in the home. So it's trying to provide a sort of more personal counterpart to the public memorials. I would say that the classics and classical imagery is very significant for both the mobilization during the war and indeed as Owen has stated, the commemoration after it.
Guys, thank you so much for coming on to give us some kind of insight into what links all of your ancient stuff with all of mine and Lockie's World War One stuff, because evidently it is a lot, and as he said earlier, it's just like something that just passes us by every single day without us really considering it. So thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join... there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, The 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.